Welcome to East Meets West, episode 143. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm flustered Roger Chang.
Why are you flustered?
No, I'm just trying to get work, and then next week there's a lot of...
Trying to get work? You sound like a hobo.
I'm trying to get work done.
Oh, okay.
But it's dependent on other people,
yes.
So to speak, so it's less like how much I can get done than waiting for other people before I can start the rest of it.
The whirlwind drama of East Meets West. So we were recording on a Saturday night instead of our usual Sunday evening.
You can't tell them that.
And then we didn't record last week because I didn't have a voice.
Yes, you suffered holiday-itis.
Holiday-itis. I blew it out on the CNET Holiday Help Desk 10-hour marathon.
Wait, I thought they stopped that. Or did they stop the webcam portion of it?
No.
No, they still did it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Someone told me that you guys stopped doing the webcam thing.
Oh, last year we didn't do video calls.
Oh, okay.
Is that what you mean by webcam thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Last year we didn't do that, but we still did the show. And this year we brought the webcam thing back. It was much easier though. When you helped out with it when you were still working at CNET 3 years ago, I guess, was the first one we did.
The one in 2004.
It was complicated still to put webcams on. Now they just did it by Skype.
Yeah,
it is Skype video call on a screen capture station. Done.
Yeah, originally it's because I wanted to use Skype, but Skype didn't support video in the way that it supports video now, where it's pretty bone simple.
Bone simple, they say. Is that a saying amongst the Changs?
I don't know.
Bone simple. What's so simple about a bone?
I don't know. What's complex
bones
about
it? Pretty complex, actually. How many? You know, there's like 270 bones in the body, or something.
Bone, singular, not plural.
And then you've got marrow.
The marrow, the red blood cell, the white blood cells, and
so leukemia. So we missed our opportunity last week to talk about Mumbai.
That was a very kind of unfortunate incident.
Well,
to understate it,
yeah.
But I mean, it just seemed. Well, I don't know. I think it underscores the volatility of the world as it is today, especially with a new presidential administration coming in next year. I think it serves to highlight, you know, how dangerous. I shouldn't say unpredictable because, you know, having read a lot about the Mumbai attacks since the actual attack occurred, it was one of those things that was, you know, in the works, or rather, it was something that was inevitably going to happen. Maybe not on the scale of Mumbai, but an attack or a terrorist-style attack somewhere in India. But I think it just underscores the volatility of, like, you know, so many places around the world. I mean, even in Canada, I mean, this is the first time that I think in recent memory, I think since the early 1900s, when there's been a crisis in government where they're, you know, the opposition parties in parliament are banding together to topple the current conservative government.
What does that have to do with the Mumbai terrorist attacks?
No, I'm just saying it's the whole volatility of the world.
Oh,
I see. It was nothing direct. I'm just saying, like
you said it was inevitable there'd be a terrorist attack in India, even in Canada.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was like, are the opposition party going to have a terrorist attack?
No. What I meant to say was essentially.
I get it now. You're talking about just.
I'm sure. Strange
things happen.
Yeah, I'm sure I mentioned volatility
perhaps,
right before.
Perhaps you did. Perhaps I am mistaken. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, ever since September 11th, 2001, in the United States, there's been a lot of talk about radical Islam. And it's been an unproductive discussion, in my opinion, because essentially a lot of commentators have lumped in every sect of Islam, from the more established protest groups of Palestine, which are still considered terrorists, to these more radical, loose groups like the group that operated in Mumbai. And I think there's something new on the scene. When you talk about Hamas,
I mean, I understand,
and those sorts of things. I mean, they really have a stated purpose, and they're very extreme.
I'm not saying
they're not, but there's not so clear of a purpose. I mean, what the Hamas wants is they want Israel out of Palestine. They want the fall of the Israeli state and the return of Palestine to Arab control. Under Palestinian control, yeah, more specifically. When you're talking to these other groups, they kind of want want Palestine under Palestinian control, and they want the U.S. to get out of Iraq. I think they just want to hurt.
I think you touched on it. I think what happened is September 11th, 2001, but I think that was kind of the watershed moment.
Well, that's when the discussion of radical Islam really caught on, but that's when
you see a lot of the former groups that used to have just a political bone to pick with their respective governments started taking on these additional quote unquote, you know, not responsibilities, but kind of tacit kind of understanding, like, okay, now we support a global kind of Islamist kind of struggle against, you know, the various governmental, political, religious, cultural, you know, quote unquote enemies that may or may not exist. So I think it was a way to kind of attach yourself to a bigger cause. I mean, people often
I'm speaking a little out of my expertise area here, but you don't necessarily see some of these older groups operating kind of worldwide. They have their zone, and they have historically stuck in that zone. These other groups are sort of in this more freelance model.
No, I think
where, you know, they're willing to take pontoon boats, you know, across the Indian Sea, and just land and start shooting people. And there was no demanding. There was no. It's almost silly to think of it as the old fashioned terrorists.
There were no terms.
There were no terms. This was pure unadulterated revenge, and I think we're seeing something new. Is where I'm going here. We're seeing something new, maybe not on the face of the earth. I mean, there's always been.
I think it has a lot of parallels to the earliest 20th century, when you had a lot of the anarchist groups, both in Europe and in North America.
It is an interesting parallel there. Right.
And it's not so much that it was essentially not so much focused on, okay, we want these five things, give it to us, and then we'll let you live in peace, or we'll give you back your people. We essentially want to destroy or dismantle the existing political government structure.
That parallel that you bring up is anarchism. Was very tied into nihilism. There were a lot of nihilist protest groups too in Europe, mostly, and in the United States, and they were against the current order, and they were sort of for nothing in a way. I mean, you can go on a long philosophical road about what that nothing was, because it wasn't just nothing at all.
But you
compare that to radical Islam, which has a very solid core belief in Islamic law and in Islamic teachings. It's not about rebelling against the current order because of the order. It's not about nihilism at all. There is something very valuable to believe in, which is the only reason that anybody would possibly be a suicide bomber, is if they had this fervent belief that they would be rewarded in the afterlife.
And the thing is, I think what you see now is, and like I just said before, is like you have these groups that, you know, might have, you know, Islam as a base religion, the same way that, you know, you had Jewish settlers, you know, trying to fight for the birth or the creation of an Israeli state during the post-World War II, and, you know, their attacks against the British mandate in the Middle East, where they're trying to attach because they want the notoriety, they want to be seen as an important facet of this kind of what they consider to be a global movement. I mean, it's one thing to say, like, you know, for example, like take a radical environmentalist. You know, instead of just being a local person and just like, hey, you know, down with McDonald's, you know, more co-ops, you can attach yourself to a larger organization. You know, whether or not you believe it or not, you attach yourself to it. Say, like, you know, say you're anti, anti any kind of motorized device because it.
Well, anarchism. Was that. Yeah. There was a global anarchist movement that all of these smaller groups attached themselves to.
Because it's something that you can belong to, right? This is my club. This is my family. This is my group.
But the sort of line above which very few movements have gone is I'm not just willing to die for my cause. I mean, that's common. Anyone who is in an armed force has essentially agreed to risk your life for
or
your cause.
Or even the
but
emergency
the,
services.
The belief that dying is actually a priority. I want to die soon for my cause. I mean, that
it's a very
that's kind of the unique branding of this, and that's not new. That's been around for 30 or 40 years.
They're really
taking it to the extreme.
Well, I mean, you know, I think they're taking it to the extreme in the form that you used to have that philosophy, but only in kind of a warrior ethos, and especially in battle. Kamikaze is a prime example, where, you know, okay, you're going to die, but when you're going to die, you're going to take a lot of them with you.
Right.
You know, in a giant ball of fire. So what's new is now this is being applied to, in a facet that hasn't been seen. You know, I can't speak for what, you know, life was like, you know, prior to the 16th century. You know, maybe people, the roving bands.
Right, because you've only been alive since the 16th century.
Well, I can only read so much recorded history before you start.
Because if your head comes away from your body.
Oh, but there can only be one, Tom. So, I mean, there's so many things involved, but, you know, the common underlying one is the religious background of all the perpetrators, whether it's in India, whether it was in New York, whether it was in the Middle East, whether it's Thailand, whether it was in Britain, or even, like, the attacks in Buenos Aires, like, 12 years ago, and a Jewish...
Well, suicide troops aren't, like you say, in Kamikaze, and then there are Celtic warriors that were, you know, were suicide troops against the Romans way back. But suicide troops is sort of, that's like a special division of your overall armed force strategy. There's no strategy with this kind of terrorism. It's public relations. They're not trying to take as many people out.
But that's what terrorism is all about. It's always been about the PR.
And I think our current media situation is what has given this kind of terrorism rise.
You mean the cult of celebrity almost?
Well, the ability to communicate broadcast, you know, in a mass media. I think mass media has made this kind of terrorism possible, because in the past,
you could do it, but no one would hear about it for a couple of months.
It wouldn't go as far and wide as you needed it to. And essentially, the main weapon that they had when they attacked Mumbai was requesting particular countries. That was the key. They wanted that reported.
Yep.
That's really all they wanted.
And the thing is, they were well coordinated, but they were lightly equipped. They had semi-automatic and automatic weapons and grenades. They didn't have an airliner filled with, you know, volatile fuel.
They were equipped with surprise. That was their biggest weapon.
The thing is, India's has had more than its fair share of similar style attacks. But again, what makes it so different? For example, there was one maybe a decade ago where terrorists at the time the government blamed on Kashmiri partisan groups attacked Congress. You know, the Indian Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So that had a political bent. But once you start attacking soft targets, it kind of changes, you know, the whole ball game, because now it's not just, we're, you know, the military or even established groups of government power, you know, whether it's Congress, you know, the president or what have you. Now it's just like anyone who you can scare and then throw into disarray. So
and essentially Al-Qaeda achieved their main objective when they attacked in 2001, when they seized control of those planes. It wasn't to blow up the World Trade Center so much. I mean, that was an objective. Their point was to have the world government or have the United States government live in fear.
Yeah,
that's essentially what they wanted to, and they achieved that.
It was to live in fear, but more than that, the fear that comes, forms into, I shouldn't say respect, but you suddenly take the other guy seriously.
It's not even just that, but to make moves that damage yourself, because it's a small band. Al-Qaeda is a small band, even when it was closely associated with the Taliban and protected in Afghanistan. You've got a very small troop here, and so any reaction from the United States is an overreaction. Yeah. It doesn't mean it's a wrong reaction, but it's an overreaction and is going to end up costing the United States much more than Al-Qaeda. So when we went to Afghanistan, that achieved their main objective, which was we spent money. We had to take money out of our economy. We had to. If we had kept it there, it would have almost been a wash because we would have hurt them as well. We would have actually sharpened our sword a little bit with having the troops be able to do maneuvers. But when we went into Iraq, we really achieved their objective for them, in my opinion, because that's where we really started to blow a lot of money. We got ourselves bogged down in something that is going to be difficult to
I don't even think they really anticipated that.
I don't think they did either.
I think it was more of a own goal kind of.
But I do think that was sort of their broad. You know, what we want is to provoke them into doing something stupid.
Well, they
didn't know it was going to be that, but they were hoping it would have that kind of.
They
effect.
Were they. My opinion is that they provoked in order to unify their various power bases around the globe.
I think that's an additional objective.
Oh, look, now the world's against us. If you don't do something now, you know, it's too late. So by showing them this is classic revolutionary struggle, right? It's a struggle. And by struggle, everyone, you know, you're fighting against the man, you're fighting against the foreign power, you're fighting against the oppressive regime.
And again, if the United States had only gone into Afghanistan and kept it at that, it would have been much harder to prove that the United States had imperial tendencies, because they brought in a native government. We did a lot of things right in Afghanistan, except not concentrate on it. It would have been a lot harder. You would have still unified some of those forces, but it would have been a lot harder. We gave them a huge propaganda boost when we went into Iraq.
The problem is
that... Because it was like, see, that's exactly what we were saying. They want to take over Afghanistan. Now they want to take over Iraq, and they're going to go after Iran or Syria next. You know they are. You have to join us now.
And the thing is, ultimately, you know, Al-Qaeda is kind of used as a catchphrase for every kind of... political movement in the Middle East that's associated with Islam, and that may or may not be the case, because you know many of the governments in the Middle East don't get along with Iran, and Iran doesn't get along with a lot of the the Arab governments in the Middle East.
Well, and there's a lot of legitimate non-terrorist political thinkers in the Middle East who believe that Israel is wrong and should go, and you know they're not for blowing up buses. But they, you know, I mean, there's a lot of sympathetic ears over there.
I think ultimately, I mean, the Al-Qaeda strategy only works so far, though, because at some point I don't think you can unify a group of so many disparate people with so many different backgrounds, ethnic groups.
Only if you're helped by the reactions of the enemy.
Well, exactly. And but even then, that takes you so far, because, okay, once you're past that, then what else? I mean... The Palestinians. For example, a
world economic crisis is right on the agenda for a lot of these groups.
Well, it'll be interesting because you know, as we see a global slowdown in the economy, all the governments both here and abroad are suffering to the great extent that you know. Who we thought would be taking, for example, China's now going to experience a decrease in their overall GDP, even though it's still increasing. The price of oil has undercut some of the fervor of, like, say, Hugo Chavez and Iran's, I can never pronounce his name, president.
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
I'll let you pronounce it. Because, you know, they were able to do certain things because they were able to get so much money for their particular product. Now, once that arch starts coming down, are people going to be voting for a political group, or are they going to be voting for their wallet at some point? Where are you going to say, okay, fine, I've done your jihad. My family's still starving.
Yeah, but you know what?
You don't think so?
No, I think it's the opposite. I think you're dead on about Ahmadinejad and Chavez, you know, because as much as they like to portray themselves as rebels, they are part of the world order. They are part of the establishment. They are political governments, and they have an interest in keeping power.
Yep.
So I think they are going to be hurt. But I think smaller rebel groups, this is exactly what they need. because you go in and you say, see, they promised you that this wasn't going to happen. They promised that they would feed you, that there would be jobs, and it hasn't happened. And why? Here's why. And they give you their propaganda line, which says, you know, we've been saying this for years, and this is what happened. And now you're out of a job, and now you're hungry. Join us in the struggle. I mean, that is, like you're saying, that is classic revolutionary
tactic. That works for a rebel group, but for Al-Qaeda, I mean, Al-Qaeda.
It's a rebel group.
In some ways it is, but some ways it isn't. I mean, it's financed in large part because of their ability to invest money in the global markets. I mean, you know, Bin Laden, one of the things about Bin Laden was that he was a rich kid, right? He didn't come from a poor family. He came from one of the wealthiest Saudi families.
That's an interesting point because I'm thinking of it more from membership. Getting bodies,
but
when you're talking about funding, you think they're going to have to lay off some people essentially. Well, no, I mean it sounds funny, but
money buys you certain things. It buys you the ability to buy equipment, buy training,
absolutely.
To buy, you know, plane tickets.
So you think their donations will go down?
I think
because the economy is bad, just like everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, like the thing is, you know.
Al-Qaeda hit with a slowdown.
If you had a family, say you had two kids, and you know Eileen was out of work, and someone said, "Hey, let's go blow up this thing," you know, so we can show them what we're at. You can only do that so long until, like, "Hey, guys, I
got
to work."
That's where I disagree, though.
You disagree?
Yeah, I do. Why? I disagree with you there because if I'm desperate, you know, and there's going to be more desperate people, I'll do it because I'm like, I got no alternative.
But what are you?
Nothing else is working. These people are fighting for me. I will help them.
No, I disagree with that.
But where I think you've got a point is the wealthy backer who they've been using as a place to get money, or the investments that they have been using to launder money. Those may be.
I think when it gets down to that, it's how much you can buy, because you've seen that in Afghanistan where loyalties switch depending on how much money.
For warlords, yeah, but I'm not talking. You're talking about
tribes. I mean, even the independent the villages and remote tribes in Afghanistan. You know,
again, the chieftains, not the plebes.
Yeah, but you know, when you
the plebes will leave the tribe and go join Al-Qaeda if they get desperate enough, if they think it's the only people that understand them and will fight for them.
But see, that's the thing is, I'm not saying that they wouldn't fight. I'm saying if you fight and you're not getting something directly out of it, either food or some sort of resource, I mean, you're just going there to cause damage. It seems kind of at some point it's like,
yeah, but you know what? I mean, if you're desperate enough, I mean, that history has shown that over and over. You'll do it. You'll go because you have no other option. And these are the people who are willing to include you.
If nobody else will. If you were single and you had no family, that I can agree with.
No, even if you have family.
But
even more if you have family.
But what would that accomplish?
Because you will finally bring down the government and get justice. You're doing it for your family. Because right now, under this current situation, my family is starving and nothing will help them. And I'm done playing the game. I'm done trying to get a job. There are no jobs. I'm prejudiced against because I'm of a ethnic group that is not in the majority here. And these people are finally going to do something drastic. And I'm going to go out. Absolutely.
I disagree. At some point, I think there's a breaking point where I agree with you. And initially, I think you can garner supporters that way. Over a lengthy campaign, people are just going to say, "Hey, what the hell? I've been at this for 2.5 years. I haven't seen my situation improve. It's gotten worse."
Well, that's true too. Over lengthy campaigns, your infantry will disappear.
I agree with you. If you can, you know, within the space of 3 months, let's bring that.
You can look at the American Revolutionary War. You can look at the Civil War. Over lengthy campaigns, deserters, people desert. But at that point, you're not in a group. Like an ordered military, which is hard to desert from. You're in a group that's like, and if you do, you're in a cult, essentially.
Yeah,
so
but
once you're in, you're in.
But remember, it's
and
not.
You can't leave.
Remember, one of the hallmarks of the quote Al-Qaeda terrorist structure is the fact that they operate as independent cells. They aren't not directly controlled.
Yeah, but if you try to leave your cell, I think you get killed.
No, I think that's a bit of an exaggeration.
I don't.
You don't think? You think it's like the mob?
I think it's like the mob or Jim Jones.
In Iraq, I mean, you had people who were once sympathetic to one of the.
Yeah, but they weren't. That's where you're talking about Al-Qaeda getting thrown around loosely. I mean, You're right. I mean, they were joining up the insurgency, but they weren't joining Al-Qaeda.
Well, that's true. But even then, at some point, I mean, the part of the surge.
That's a good example of where people joined up on one side sort of tentatively and then said, you know what, this isn't in our best interests.
It took
leaders to say, you know what, I'm going to take my people and we're going to fight against the insurgency now.
Well, it wasn't
like an uprising from the bottom. It was an uprising led from the top.
It was led from outsiders. They were trying to.
No. The change, the awakening. That was tribal leaders. That was,
Oh yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
But even then, I mean, even at some point, you know, the leaders can only go so far before the supporters say, "Hey, look, you know, you promised."
Well, you have to have the support, right? Yeah, it's a delicate balance.
The thing is, you need the support. You cannot take for granted their support indefinitely if you cannot provide them.
No, you have to continually revive it, and that's where the brilliance of these prophetic people like Bin Laden, who might not even still be alive, but it doesn't matter because you use them as the inspiration to keep the troops' spirits up.
Well, what Al-Qaeda did,
and then you use fear on the other side.
Well, what Al-Qaeda did was they provided money. It's like, hey, if you go off yourself with a suicide bomb, your family will be taken care of.
Yeah,
you need to provide, and that's what I'm saying. You need to provide those resources because no one's dumb enough to say I'm going to blow myself up. No advancement for my family. They're not going to get any.
Yeah, they are. There are plenty of people who are dumb enough to do that. Actually, not enough.
I agree with you on that. I think they're a minority. I think a percentage. I mean, even
it's an unusual situation.
You know, one of the big things with all the suicide bombers was that their family would get.
That's a way to expand the ranks of the suicide bombers.
Well, because they weren't big to
begin
with.
They're still fanatics who will do it anyway.
Just because they're fanatics doesn't mean they don't want to take the economic interest of their...
I would say the majority of suicide bombers aren't doing it for the money.
I think they are.
No, I disagree. I think at rock bottom, suicide bombers are generally doing it because they think they will be welcomed in heaven.
I think
you've been able to bring in a few more by providing this pension plan.
I think what it is that they're given a financial compensation. Two, they get the opportunity to get back at those people that have caused them harm. So it's a win-win.
But I think that first part is new, and I think there's some people that are doing it for that. But I think the old-fashioned suicide bomber did it for revenge, glory, and virgins welcome them in heaven.
Well, it remains to be seen.
Yeah.
Until we actually, do a fine-tooth brain picking.
All right. Well, that does it for us this week. Thanks for listening, folks. You can make comments on this topic or any topic we've talked about at subbrilliant.com/EMW.
Thank you very much for listening.
Bye.